even though I don't really use the audio from this anyway, but it's worth having just in case. But so
sure.
You catch us in progress here at the Swap Meet Podcast. My name is Daniel Hanlon.
My name is Niall McCann.
And Niall just made possibly the only Shakespeare sister related joke to be made this year, would you say? By anybody?
Oh, somebody loves them.
I think I fancied the gothy looking one when I was younger. You better hope and pray that you make it safe back to your own world.
The evil one, Dan, do you mean?
Yeah,
the evil
one? I like the evil one, yeah.
Oh my goodness.
If I was to make a decision between the two of them, it would have been the evil one.
Oh, surely she would just be messing with your head constantly.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's exactly what would happen, but it would burn brightly while it did.
Okay.
All right.
Niall, any crack at all?
No crack whatsoever. Nothing is happening. Nothing is happening to anyone or around anyone.
Did you not go for some
Indian variant we were talking about?
We were just talking about the Indian variant, yeah, before we pressed record. Did you
get
out
for all that's happening?
Did you get out for outside pints on Monday?
No, I did not. There was some kind of commotion happened near my house because I heard it Monday evening.
Like fisticuffs?
I didn't. There must have been something like that, yeah. I don't know. There was a lot of chatter.
You're down that end of town.
How dare you? They're going to be doing it up. It's going to be called St. Nicholas's Quarter. They're putting millions into it, apparently.
I saw that. Yeah. It's going to be the Bridge Street revival. I mean, it's all gone downhill since they closed the Sunshine Bar. The Stag's Head is still there. Yeah. Were you ever in the Sunshine Bar? Did you frequent that when you were younger?
Just explain to people what the Sunshine Bar was. I'm trying to branch our audience beyond this sort of North Dundalk region.
It was a very rough little pub in Bridge Street in Dundalk, frequented by bikers and ne'er-do-wells, and also
and children,
very young bands. So all the young bands got gigs because ID was not something that anyone ever requested off us 15-year-olds. So that's where my first band, we played in there. We played in there quite a bit, actually. We were every other week, I'd say. Maybe that's an exaggeration, but we did play in there quite a bit. And a scary biker came up to me one night and said, "Are you Hanlon?" And I was like, "Yeah." And he was like, "You have any issues? No. Any bother in this place? You come to me." And it turns out he was a cousin of mine. Big, scary-looking biker dude. Looked like he could have picked me up like this, like in a cartoon, by grabbing the top of my head, like it just moving me from one side to the other. But it turns out, he was a cousin of mine, and he told me if I ever had any bother to find him, and he'd crack some skulls for me.
Did you ever have recourse to go looking for him?
No, it was sketchy. It was really sketchy, but we kind of got left alone. It was people trying to sell drugs and stuff, like, you know, and none of us had any money bar what they gave us from behind the bar for the gig, which was usually pints.
So you were like a neutral presence in the bar.
Yeah, yeah.
Not but worth it, fucking with and not worth...
no money.
Not
no
causing money. Enough hassle.
Yeah, not funding the criminal underworld either. Good times, though.
Good things come to those who wait. Yeah, exactly. It's a story, isn't it? You get to tell it on a podcast.
Yeah.
Who'd have thunk that
when you were 15? They were good days. And like we thought we were fucking brilliant. But when you listen back to the tapes, you're like, oh my God, why is my guitar so out of tune? You know, stuff like that.
Give us a sample set list that you would have thrown out there.
Our singer was obsessed with Radiohead. So we did some Radiohead songs in the same order that they're on the albums. We did The Bends and High and Dry in a row with the same way it is on The Bends album. And he could hit the notes as well. He was a good singer. And what else? We had three or four of our own songs. One was an instrumental called The Eternal Journey. And we just called it that because it was really long.
That's allowed.
We had a song that
seems like it never ends.
Yeah. We had a song that was exactly the same chords as Smells Like Teen Spirit that was called The Interrogator. We did Dirty Magic by The Offspring. We did Break On Through by The Doors. We did Nancy Boy by Placebo. Do you know that song?
No.
Lose my clothes, lose my lube, cruising for a piece of fun.
you'd probably know it if you heard it. But that was I think that was the first man I ever fancied a little bit, was Brian Molko from Placebo.
First of many.
Yeah, I just remember seeing that the footage of the McGlastonbury, and it's like, that's a pretty attractive dude, to be fair.
I have no image in my head for that, none whatsoever. It's good to be good looking. You can get away with stuff when you're good looking. That's my theory.
Well, you can get away with being in a sort of fleetingly good indie band, and people still remember you. The first time we ever played in there, we were using, because I don't think I even had an amplifier. We were using the band that we were going on first on a night of like five bands or something. It was the first time I'd ever played like a gig in a band. And you know, distortion pedals for guitars, you know, you press them with your foot and then you get that sound. I had to borrow the one off the band that was on after us. And it was a death metal distortion pedal. It had a picture of a skull on it, like, you know, this kind of thing. And when I hit it to do my lead parts or whatever in like Radiohead songs or whatever, the thing just went, you know, it sounded like a razor, you know.
Do you remember the fella, was he in the 80s? The very, very, very suntanned fella that used to sell Braun lady shavers.
On TV?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
I didn't dream him, did I? Just even at the time, I remember being, that's kind of a weird way to try and sell your lady shavers, lady razors.
With a really tan man. You know,
quite an elderly man, gray hair, shockingly white gray hair. Shockingly white or insistently gray. And a deep, deep suntan, like a bright Oompa Loompa suntan, an American, and he used to sell Braun. So when other razor companies had like women jogging along a beach and so on, Braun
had this old guy who talked like Stan Lee saying, "When you need to shave your underarm here."
I'm almost certain that's true.
I have to look it up.
Stand to be corrected on that.
Obviously, if I find a clip of this man, I will drop it in here. But I don't know if YouTube collect the Braun ads. I don't know what we were watching the other night, but an ad for Guinness came on, and it was all these trendy, ethnically diverse people in a nightclub dancing around drinking Guinness. And I turned around the cat and I said, "They have no idea how to sell this anymore." There's just like, their advertising campaigns are all just like flailing around, like, you know, cool people in a nightclub, you know, like our lads. I don't know who drinks Guinness now.
That's the wrong drink for that. You don't want to do that. Don't be drinking Guinness while you're dancing in a nightclub.
But some people do, and it's you just this like sweaty, bloated fucking bag of soup by that point. Just, like,
you can see it in them. You can see it in there. Like, oh, he was on the Guinness. You see it and smell it, frankly. And it's you might as well just put a thing of Bisto on your head and rock out to the dance floor. Like, it's the same.
It's like having eaten like a six course meal or something. Like, you know, every pint is like a course.
Which apparently I was watching a thing the other night on the internet, the Young Turks it was, and they had a
sort of news program, right? Quote-unquote news program.
Had this big list of countries with the most binge drinking, and Ireland smashed it on their list. And I don't believe it. No, I don't believe that.
Why not?
Because like, we weren't like just the top of the list. We were like more than double the next one down. Now, I don't believe we drink that differently to, say, the Brits. And I know the fucking Eastern Europeans are crazy heavy drinkers. But we are more... If there was like three or four at the top that it could have been, and the Irish, Poland just pipped at the post by Ireland. But no, there's absolutely zero way we binge drink more than double the next people.
Figures for binge drinking are really weird. I have two beers beside me here. It's probably all right. I was going to say that's probably binge drinking, but I suppose if you are someone that goes out at the weekend and maybe you don't drink at all or very little during the week, and then you go out, you know, when people went out on Saturday night and you fucking filled your boots, like, you know, that might be that might be tipping the scales a little bit. Because I think most Irish people, at least when I was growing up, did that.
Yeah.
Like a night's drinking, yeah, even as quiet night.
Do most British people not do?
You might be. We were talking about this the other day, myself and Kat, and I was wondering if, I don't know if young people think drinking or smoking is that cool anymore. Do you know what I mean?
With role models like me, Dan, how could they doubt it?
My friend Shane Toman, I remember when we were kids and Pulp Fiction came out, I remember years later, he was saying, like, when I saw that film, I was like, I knew I could never get a gun, but I could fucking smoke. What was I going to say? Yeah, we had a lot of smoking role models back then. People who looked cool smoking, you know, like
Hannibal fucking, from the BDA team.
Hannibal from the A team. Kurt Cobain, Popeye.
But was he smoking or did he just use that to whistle?
He was putting spinach in it quite a lot of the time, using it like a straw.
He was. That was quite a versatile implement. I could understand, even if he quit, why he'd keep that around.
It just keeps holes in me pipes. That's how I eat me spinach.
Keeping it modern here, folks, with the Popeye talk. There's a vein of Popeye running through this podcast.
Yeah, and we're generally quite affectionate towards him, I've noticed.
Yeah.
None of your revisionism here, Sorrow.
Especially the deconstructionist Popeye film. Is it even deconstructionist? What's it deconstructing? It probably isn't. Like, you know, I don't know what it is.
I have no idea. I have no idea what that fucking thing is. I really don't. I've been on an old 90s thrillers kick.
What kind of, what? Like, give us some titles.
We watched Sneakers at the weekend. We watched The Fugitive. I say we watched The Fugitive. I fell asleep
quite early. I've seen it through osmosis, probably. Even if you've never sat down and watched The Fugitive. We got a fugitive.
Hello.
Been on the run for approximately 24 hours. The amount of parodies
I want to search every doghouse, henhouse, outhouse.
Did you ever watch, there's a film that I remember seeing when I was very young, but I only remember sort of little sort of snippets of it. Pacific Heights with Michael Keaton in it, where he's like a neighbor, like a weird neighbor.
Yeah, San Francisco, one of those San Francisco hill houses.
That's it. That's something I often wonder, is it worth going back and watching? Because Michael Keaton as a creepy neighbor on paper sounds like it should be really good.
Fucking swab it then, because I want to see that one. I remember that one. I think I watched that when I was a kid. Who was the woman in it?
In my head, I figured it was someone big. I think it was Jeff Daniels.
Bridget Fonda or something?
And that's who I'm thinking. Yeah, I think it might have been Bridget Fonda.
I was thinking the exactly thing. So, same thing. So,
yeah, because isn't that around the time that maybe Single White Female came out? Wasn't that her?
Yeah, it was her.
And Nikita.
Wasn't she in Nikita? Yeah.
Let's remember that then. So, that's next week's swap sorted out. I've been watching a lot of old sitcoms, like British sitcoms from the 70s and 80s on Daily Motion, because for some reason they've got a massive library of English sitcoms up there. Like Yes Ministers up
there. Which ones?
Yes Ministers. Ever Decreasing. Have you ever watched Ever Decreasing Circles?
Oh, not since I was a kid, no.
Oh, man, it's, what do you call him?
Isn't that the dude with the mustache?
No, it's your man from The Good Life, the guy who played the husband in The Good Wife. Good Life, brother.
Yeah.
Richard Briers.
Hello. What are you doing in there?
Just having a look around.
Do you realise there are people's private trousers hanging on hooks in those dressing rooms?
I wasn't going through the pockets.
I'm not saying you are. I'm just saying that private trousers have a right to hang on hooks without people wandering in and looking at them.
Assuming that trousers have opinions.
Not to say sensitivity. Can a pair of trousers blush?
Do you hear this conversation, Howard? I bring up a pair of trousers just as a way of talking, and people... All right, forget trousers. All I'm asking is, what are you doing up here altogether?
Well, I couldn't come in bits, could I?
I don't believe this conversation.
Neither do I.
Yeah, Richard Bramble was in my head, and I was like, that's not quite it. No, it's just Briers Bramble. I was like, that's not right, I know.
Wilfred Bramble is Steptoe.
Steptoe, who was Irish?
Yeah, he was. He's in. He plays Paul McCartney's uncle in A Hard Day's Night. Funny enough, and he uses his Irish accent in that. Oh, Paul, you wouldn't sign these pictures for me, would you? You know, that's what he sounds like in that. Like, you know, so... But apparently...
Well, he could certainly do the accent.
I read somewhere that because he wore... A little bit like Frank Kelly in Father Ted, because he wore so much gross makeup to play Steptoe, after an episode, he was able to just wash everything off and walk out of his dressing room and no one really knew who he was, because he was quite... he was a dapper man. Like, if you see him in Hard Day's Night, he's got the suit on and, like... So when he would leave after shooting an episode of Steptoe, people wouldn't even recognize him. Like, you know,
I would believe that he outlived the young fella, didn't he?
That's bananas, did he?
I believe so. He had quite a pronounced drinking
problem. You dirty old man!
Look what you've done to me! Look what you've done to me again!
It sounds like Carl Barat from the Libertines.
No.
Please kill me.
Maybe they sound very similar.
We've just come up with a new tribute band, the Steptoe Libertines tribute band.
Oh, dear. They did a... Didn't they do a theater last episode of Steptoe? An episode that was on, like, in the West End or somewhere like
they
that.
They tried to do a musical, I believe, and it didn't... fly.
It was... I remember watching it. It must have been a documentary. You know the way they do these documentaries about these old programs. But they interviewed the writer, and apparently they had like a big long last episode that was Steptoe's place on the stage, and you come in and people are visiting it because it was the scene of a gruesome murder. And then it sort of flashbacks, this guy from Australia sort of flashback. It's a Steptoe and Son episode on stage in flashback that you're basically leading up to him murdering his father in.
That's
which
bonkers.
Would not have been the first episode of Steptoe that was that sort of lent that way.
Well, this is the thing. Like, they talk about fucking quote-unquote dark comedy starting with, like, The Office or whatever, but it really didn't. Like, it was going... Like, the Steptoe was one of the darkest shows ever made. Like, you know?
Yeah, it is. It is. It was terrible. It was brilliant.
Yeah.
But it was... it went places.
So, Niall, this is the Swap Meet podcast. And... you and I, on a fortnightly basis, get together. We swap pop cultural artifacts, films, albums, TV shows, that kind of thing. And we talk about
do
it.
That.
So what I did was I gave you... Did you listen to... I specifically said the album, but did you watch the film?
I listened to the album, and I have to say I wasn't super liking it.
Okay, fair enough.
But being the dedicated podcaster I am, Danny, I said... the fucking whole film was on YouTube, just sitting there. So I watched and became quite turned around, I have to say. I was listening to the album today. I was kind of enjoying it again. I feel good, I feel bad, I feel happy, I feel sad. Am I in love? I must be in love. I feel rich, I feel poor. So Eric Idle made this TV show called Rutland Weekend Television, and Neil Innes, who is the main man in the Ruttles and did music for Python down through the years, he's the guy, Brave Sir Robin ran away, bravely ran away, away, that's him. And he had an actual hit with the Urban Spaceman. Did, that wasn't
was
that
the,
an actual
the Bonzo Dog
the Urban
band.
Spaceman,
yeah.
Baby, I got
and that's that funny enough produced by Paul McCartney. Rutland Weekend Television was basically like a shite television station, and that was the gag. Because apparently they got almost no money to make it, so they kind of used that to their advantage and everything looked cheap as fuck. It's kind of sort of basement Python. Like, it's some of it's all right, but it is very sort of, it's like substandard Python a little bit.
Ham sandwich, bucket and water plastic, Duralex, rubber McFisher's underwear. Plug rapid emulsion, sick custard without sustenance in Kipling Duff geriatric scenery, maximizes press insulating devilment, grunting sapphire clubs, incidentally. But tonight, sandpan Bombay Bermuda in diphtheria rustic McAlpine splendor, rabbit and fut-fut-fooey jugs rapidly, big bio rule liners must green gauges micturate with nipples and tiptoe rustling machinery, rustically inclined. Good evening and welcome.
Hello.
Foreskin mousetrap view Mount Everest tin tray lobotomy in England.
Saddleback, saddleback. Lechery billboard kettlebum, simpering, snuff-masticated, bow-side, handset, lemonade enterprisingly appetite, rubber eyes, plum joint, curvaceously mucking squirrels.
I see.
One of the things that was on it was Neil Innes would write musical parodies, and they would have spoof episodes of like Top of the Pops or Old Grey Whistle Test and this kind of stuff. So one song he wrote was that one, I Must Be In Love, and it came out kind of beatly. Around that time, Eric Idle was actually moved to the US, and through some sequence of events, they managed to get that Ruttle song, I Must Be In Love, played on Saturday Night Live. I'm not sure exactly how it happened, but through some series of events, it did. And then Lorne Michaels was like, you should do a spoof Beatles film. We'll put it, and he put up the money for it. So that's why it looks better than Rutland Weekend Television, because there was some actual money put into it. So Neil Innes had something like 2 weeks to go and write 20 Beatles songs, this kind of crack, like, you know. So
fair play, he nailed it, like.
Apart from one or two songs, the spoofs of the early years are just okay. But the more psychedelic pastiches later on in the album, I think, are just brilliant.
Just sounded like a sort of thing you would hear on the radio in the 60s to me. Like, it didn't sort of register with me that anything very funky was going on. And then I watched the TV film or the whatever it is.
Did you enjoy the film?
Yeah, I thought it was hilarious.
It is good, really, really. And he's actually, Neil Innes is amazing as John Lennon. He's a more convincing John Lennon than Eric Idle is a Paul McCartney.
Yes, he is.
But there's all I was going to say was there's a bit of controversy about that, because Eric Idle doesn't play on any of the music and wasn't supposed to be in the band in the film. But when it came time to make it, I think he kind of pulled rank and was like, I want to be in the band as well. Apparently there's a bit of animosity as to who really sort of, you know, came up with the Ruttles or whatever. Like, you know, like I don't think Neil Innes had anything to do with the writing of the film, but obviously they had a lot to work with that music, like, you know, and he's very good in it as John Lennon. But yeah, Eric Idle is miming along to tracks he didn't play on that film.
Yeah, I mean, would the film work if it didn't have those sort of convincing Beatles?
They had to be good. Comforts. They had to be like plausible Beatles songs, you know. And I watched the film after listening to the album again for a while. I've been like torturing my wife and son with this album now for a few months because I just got really into it. Like, I just think some of the songs on it are great. Like, you know, I really like I Must Be In Love. I really like Ouch, Making My Heart Out. Yeah. Ouch. Yeah. And some of them are brilliant. Yeah. Like I think I might like Love Life more than I like All You Need Is Love.
To live, to love is sublime. Weather's a wind.
Isn't it? What's the Get Back one?
Get up and go.
But it's almost just Get Back.
Because Eric Idle was kind of pally with George Harrison, because George Harrison funded The Life of Brian, apparently George Harrison gave him an unfinished documentary about the Beatles that was never released. And this was in the mid-70s, so they'd only been split up like 5 or 6 years. And there's a lot of the Ruttles thing that's like beat for beat, that documentary that never actually got... it got done eventually as the anthology, but that was 20 years later, but apparently they had a lot of stuff to work with where they could get the scenes and the look of it really bang on,
I did hear him say that in an interview, Idle, that of them all, Paul McCartney seemed to be the one that was kind of like, really?
Well, his character was the character of Paul, and it was a bit of an idiot. And I also think he was a bit sore about, or I think it was John Lennon, because John Lennon really liked it, and apparently Yoko really liked it as well, even though she's a Nazi in it. But John Lennon said to Neil Innes, he was like, "This Get Up and Go, you're really pushing it with that. I really think Paul should have a writing credit on that one."
It's incredibly similar.
Yeah.
It's the same song, but it's incredibly similar.
The thing about some of those songs is because they're A, D, and G or whatever, you can't really, some of that stuff you can't really copyright, because it's like, it is just like a rock shuffle, really. There's not an awful lot to copyright there. It's not like some really well-known Mozart thing that you're just ripping off or whatever. It is the kind of thing that a million bands do, but yeah, it is very close. It's exactly the same song. I don't know why I'm defending it. I just really like Neil Innes.
Yeah, but it's not even as if, there was one of the songs really I kind of was laughing out loud laughing out loud at. Living in Hope.
Oh, yeah. I love it. Yeah. That's a big song in our house at the minute. I grew up in the country beside a chicken shack. So I left for the city and I didn't look back. Now I'm living in hope. Living in hope. Living in hope. Living in hope. Yes, I'm living in hope. Living in hope. Living in hope. Walking around the city.
I misheard that as living in hole.
Oh, that would have been good. No.
Yeah, because the whole first verse is about a guy getting up from his country home and have to go off and make it in the big city, and then give it living in Hull.
Oh, that would have been great. Oh, that's
that was hilarious.
That would have been great.
And then I realized, it's living in Hope. I thought, that's not as funny as the guy determined to make it in the bright lights of Hull.
Yeah, that's a shame, actually. Yeah, that's a trick missed by the Ruttles.
But there's no tricks in it. He rewrote lyrics to not come together. What were we talking about? Get back. It's not like there's a joke in the lyrics. It's just different lyrics to the song.
That one is. Yeah, that's probably like the least imagination on the whole thing. But
and look, he had to do the whole. He had to write 20 songs in a fortnight. So fair enough. But they're sort of meticulous pastiches, but I don't even know if you could call them a parody. I don't know that there's a joke there. Now, it works fantastically for the film, but the album itself, I'm like, really?
They're jokes if you're a Beatles fan. You can hear that there's definitely jokes in it if you're a Beatles fan.
Okay, fair enough.
I guess I was listening to it during the week, and that did kind of occur to me, because I was listening to hold my hand, yeah, yeah, hold my hand, you know that one? And it's like,
yeah, yeah,
it's such a great parody because the intro is 8 days a week. The kind of stops and starts and the way that the guitar is played in the background is All My Lovin'. And then they have the lyrics are please, please hold my hand. So it's like he's hitting three fucking moles with the same mallet or whatever. Like, you know, it's just, it's really well done.
I'm not the kind of guy who likes to play Big Brother, but I've just seen your date outside. He's with another. I saw you both come in, and clearly you're not meant for him. So please, please hold my hand. Hold my hand.
I do kind of feel like some of his kind of originality and stuff kind of creeps into it as well. Like, he is a good songwriter. He's written, he doesn't just do pastiches. Like, he's put out his own albums and that. Actually, he put out, do you know that song, How Sweet to Be an Idiot, of his?
No.
It kind of goes, how sweet to be an idiot. And it's exactly like Oasis's I'm free to be whatever I... And it's the same melody, like, you know. So it's kind of funny that, like, this fella who's well-known for Beatles pastiches then has to fucking take Noel Gallagher to court. Because Noel Gallagher is quite well-known for lifting Beatles songs. And then, like, but then he's also lifting sub-Beatles songs as well, like, you know.
But does that mean, wait, he took Noel Gallagher to court?
I think he did, yeah. I think it was settled out of court because it's really blatant. Like, it's not... I don't know whether it was him or the management or what, but someone took Noel Gallagher to court, like, which is kind of cheeky.
It's very fucking cheeky. That I can't get over that.
I'll have to check that. I'm not sure whether that actually happened. I'll have to check it. The plagiarism is clear, but I'll have to double check my facts on whether or not. Like, Noel Gallagher, I think, said in some interview that they were taking the court, but he can't be trusted either. Like, you know, there's one of the songs on it that actually sounds really like some of the kind of leaden kind of ballads that Oasis put out near the end of their career. The Cheese and Onions, you know, that song. Cheese and Onions really sounds like Liam Gallagher. It actually, more so than Oasis, it sounds like what Liam Gallagher's doing now, those kind of ballads he's doing.
Okay. What is Liam Gallagher doing now? What's he up to these days?
He had a big song out of Christmas, a kind of a ballad. Like, his stuff is mainly kind of those kind of ballady kind of things that Oasis were doing. And he has, he does a lot of Oasis songs in his set as well. Like, he did a thing around Christmas of a gig that he filmed going down a barge down the Thames, like a really big barge, and the band were set up on it playing. It was like an hour long or something. I don't really like his...
Like the Queen or Bob Geldof.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I don't like his solo stuff at all. I just think it's all the stuff that people would slot. It's LA professional songwriters trying to write him Oasis-style songs, and it's just a bit fucking naff, you know?
How different is that to what's his name?
Because Neil Innes, the thing that I like about the Ruttles is that it's done with affection. I think it's like he's not taking the piss out of the Beatles. Like, he's doing it with affection. I just feel like the intentions are good. There's nothing cynical about it. Whereas I feel like some of this shit that's been written for Liam by LA sort of songsters, the same people that write for Adele and all these kind of people, like, you know, they're kind of...
Adele wrote her own stuff.
I think she works with people. I think she writes a lot of her own lyrics, but she works with people on tracks. But I do think these people are cynically trying to make Oasis songs for Liam to sing. As a fan of the original band, I think they just sound shite. I don't like them.
Well, once you have a distinctive sound, it's hard to... It's hard to get out of it.
I mean, he's a singer. He's not really a songwriter. So he has to do something. Like, you know, he's not going to, like, he's not, you know, he's kind of, he can't really generate his own stuff. Like, you know, so he had, like, he's going to have to get someone to write it. So I just wish maybe it was someone a little bit closer to the source than these kind of hired guns, you know.
I bet they all fucking worship the shit he worships.
I'd say for them, like, look, they're just songwriters and they're doing what they're being paid to do. But I feel like to them, it's more of like a puzzle. Yeah. Like, how can we put together an Oasis-style thing for this guy that sounds somewhat contemporary, that will sound good on the radio? Like, in a way that Oasis didn't think about that kind of stuff. They just did what came natural to them, you know?
But do you know comedians? You know, was it on the Black and White Night, where Elvis Costello, where Roy Orbison sang Comedians? Which is an Elvis Costello song. It's a great song, but it, in my head, is a Roy Orbison song. If I hear Elvis Costello sing it, it just sounds weird. But then, you know what? This is a bad... I'm not even going to continue with my thought on that, because everything that comes out of Elvis Costello sounds weird to me. I don't know why.
Well, I mean, but also, like, if Roy Orbison does your song, it's Roy's song then.
I will say that Comedians, the smartest thing Costello could have done with Comedians was find Roy Orbison and get him to sing it. It like sounds like a Roy Orbison song. It has that really big chorus that just builds and builds and builds. Sometimes things just suit people, you know?
He's good at that. He's good at writing songs in someone else's style and then presenting them to those people and saying the song would really suit you. He's good at that. He can move around in different styles. Like, he did stuff with Burt Bacharach. He did stuff with The Roots. He did stuff with fucking guy whose name escapes me now. Singer Alan Toussaint, singer-songwriter from New Orleans. And he can work for really well in those. And you don't like him at all, Elvis Costello. I'm not like a super fan or anything, but I do have stuff I like that he does.
Yeah, I like Oliver's Army. What can I tell you?
Do you know that when they wrote that album that Oliver's Army is on, they were trying to get stuff that they could play on the radio. And Oliver's Army was just like a kind of a so-so song they were working on until the piano player in the Attractions, I don't know what his name is, started playing those kind of Dancing Queen piano parts over it. And all of a sudden it was like, oh, this fucking sounds great.
I have to say, post-pandemic, all of ABBA are still alive. That would reboot the world, the global economy in one fell swoop.
I can't be doing with ABBA. I get that it's good. I understand that it's good, but it really annoys me.
There would be no end to the zeros on the check for an ABBA reunion.
Yeah, no, you're right. But doesn't the blonde one live on an island somewhere and she doesn't do interviews or anything? She's like, absolutely not. No interest. Goodbye.
Are they wealthy? Did they do well out of it? Oh, were God. They one the, of those two groups lads, that the, was screwed? Like
the two lads wrote all the songs. They must be. They must be.
But what about the two women?
Well, yeah. I mean,
oh my God, they were married. Do they have alimony then? Is that how they're getting their cut?
I have no idea. I guess it would be assets, wouldn't it? Like, they were all approached around the time of Mamma Mia and all that to reunite, and at least one of them was like, "No, absolutely not." I mean,
people would love that.
Their stuff is so annoying, though. I don't know. I just can't connect with it at all. Dancing Queen, out of everything, is a song I can listen to, but anytime I try to listen to ABBA, I'm always like, yeah, this is really good. And I listen to like, and halfway through a song, I'm just like, what am I doing, man? This isn't speaking to me at all. What the fuck are they singing about?
What about The Winner Takes It All or something soulful and heartfelt?
Yeah,
like
you can't, look, you can't argue with The Winner Takes It All. That's fair enough. I don't want to talk about things we've gone through, though it's hurting me. Now it's history. I played all my cards, and that's what you've done too. Nothing more to say, no more ace to play. The winner takes it all, the loser standing small beside the victory. That's a destiny. I was in your arms, thinking I belong there. I figured it made sense. The Way Old Friends Do, is that an ABBA song?
Is that an ABBA song?
I for some reason I had it in my head that was an ABBA song. I'm googling that as well, because I am, My recollections of things are very questionable tonight, so I'm going to Google that. It was adopted by a lot of Irish country singers, but I just want to say, The Way Old Friends Do, yeah, it is ABBA. ABBA wrote that song.
Fraternity took it over, did they?
Oh, yeah. I mean, is it Philomena Begley that does it? I remember there used to be a show on LMFM that would use it as its either its intro or its outro music every Sunday. And I just have kind of a soft spot for that song. I played in a wedding band where we did Waterloo, and Waterloo's good fun to play, even though the song annoys me, but it's good crack to play in the guitar. Why? It's just big open D chords, and yeah, you know, like it's good crack. But
why would it annoy you? It is the ultimate good crack song. Like,
I don't know. I just don't like it. I don't know what their buzz is.
Because I was having a conversation with somebody during the week about Waterloo, the phrase, he met his Waterloo, and she'd never heard it. She had no idea what it was or how it was being used. And I was like, did you not see it? Like, when I was a kid, if we were driving down the road and there was a badger sort of schmooshed in the middle of the road, my father would just say, oh, that badger met his Waterloo. It was just a thing. It's like, no, that's not a saying.
I've never heard it. It definitely fucking is a saying. Obviously I know what it means, but I've never heard it. I don't think.
We would have used that quite routinely in the McCann household. Oh, maybe he met his Waterloo.
Maybe born it's a saying.
Oh, the fucking beans met the Waterloo.
Maybe your dad generated that saying.
He might have. He also, maybe he had, and then I was, because the conversation went on, and he might have had a bit of a Napoleon fixation or something, because he did used to say, not tonight, Josephine. Not tonight, Josephine. He's like, Daddy, can we stay up? Not tonight, Josephine. Twice tomorrow night. I was like, is that something you say to kids?
It's certainly unusual, but it's funny.
Not tonight, Josephine. Twice tomorrow night. Oh, dear. Oh.
That's hilarious.
But Napoleon had a bit of was a bit on vogue in the 70s, wasn't he? Wasn't Richard Chamberlain or somebody like that playing him in big historic dramas and
maybe
and
so
stuff like
and
that?
And then didn't you have, what was the band that sang about Rasputin?
Boney M. were just the invention of this German guy. He wrote That's the songs, crazy. He produced it, he got some English folk to jump around in front of it, and they were huge hit machine hit makers that everybody loved better part of a decade.
Mary's Boy Child, Jesus Christ.
Mary's Boy Child, Jesus Christ.
Didn't they do the Rivers of Babylon or Bridges of Babylon?
By the rivers of Babylon.
I saw the guy who wrote that.
Everybody loves Boney M.
I saw Jimmy Cliff who's like a reggae legend in the Roisin Dove years ago, and he did that song. I don't know if I'm not sure if he wrote it or not, but he did a great version of it.
Well, look, the guy behind Boney M was a German. He did it for the better part of a decade. Everybody loved it. He kind of went out. He's like, I want to do something new, something a bit more hip hoppy, a bit funkier. To create Milli Vanilli. And everybody went fucking apeshit. And I felt a bit sorry for him. He was like, you fucking love Boney M. And I was doing the exact same thing with Boney M. What the fuck is the problem now?
Were Boney M not the actual musicians, though. Like that, what the woman who sings Mary's Boy Child, I feel like that's, she is actually a singer on those tracks, though, correct?
I wouldn't be that certain of. Possibly, yeah, possibly.
It sounds like the same woman anyway, but then again, it might be someone miming, but I don't think he got
the main guy. The main guy, I don't think, was the singer. He was just dancing about, like he was just told to be as energetic as possible on whatever, on Top of the Pops. That was his remit. Band.
I think I have one of their records downstairs because I've got some of my dad's records, like, and yeah, bony fucking M. Like, what's the M for?
But, nothing. It's none of it. It's, yeah, it's just one German guy who thought, hey, call it Bonnie.
We
shall call it Bonnie M and send in the United Kingdom. They love this shit.
It was
totally engineered. Go on.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, wasn't Bonnie M Del Boy's favorite band?
Could have been.
I think this was...
Del Boy loved all of that.
Why don't you get your Bonnie M record, Del? We could have a good old knees up. I think it doesn't Rodney say that to him at granddad's funeral.
Yeah, yeah. Or but Del had that ABBA line as well. Oh, I told you she was a bit rough. You did not. You told me she was like that one out of the ABBA. Yeah, I meant the one with a beard.
There's a really good scene in one of those Only Fools and Horses where Del's got headphones on. He's listening to something and he's kind of moving his fingers around as if he's conducting an orchestra. And he takes the headphones off and he just goes, I don't care what anybody says. You can't knock the Who.
The poor old Who. Aren't they just the Kinks for welders?
No, the Kinks and the Who are two very different propositions altogether.
It's an Alan Partridge line when who was he interviewing? Roger Daltrey, I think.
Did he say that? The Who or the Kinks for welders?
So the Who. Some people say, aren't they just the Kinks for welders? What? Basically.
You know what I've been listening to again recently is, do you ever listen to Blue Jam, the Chris Morris thing?
No, I never have. You keep telling me about it, though.
I don't know how we would swap because it's three seasons of a radio show. I don't know how you'd go about swapping it because there's loads of it and it's not like you could pick one episode of it or whatever.
Susie and a thin man found me in the park. I was walking slowly round the pond and making the bones in my nose tickle by hooting. Susie said my mother had tipped her off after hearing my voice while throwing stones at the ducks. I'd been there a day and a half. It's because of my job, I explained. Susie looked doubtful. Batch testing new age CDs. But Hal said he didn't hire you in the end, she said. That would explain why he hasn't paid me. The thin man with Susie coughed up a small laugh and spat it onto the ground. You'd better come to dinner on Saturday, she said. Clive will be there too. She squeezed the man's arm. Clive is the suicide journalist. He was ghostly pale with black hair and a sad wit in his eyes. I'd say he looked like John Cusack if I could remember who the hell John Cusack was. As he gazed moodily at the pond, Susie explained that Clive had announced in his weekly column that he had 6 months to live. On April the 15th, he would be committing suicide, and until then, he would write about how it felt to be staring death in the face. Clive took out a notebook and mumbled something about the blackness of a moorhen.
Just these really unsettling sketches to like, but if you can get them on that archive.org website. I don't know what's going on over there. They seem to just be able to put whatever they want up there and somehow it's legal. But you can download the full original episodes.
You're on your honor on archive.org, Dan. You're not supposed to tell anybody about it.
First You've rule of archive.org.
We've mentioned it on Swap Meet. It's over. That's the end of archive.org.
Close it there. And it wasn't the day today. That was the first thing that, or not the day today. The radio version was called On the Hour. It wasn't that the first thing that Alan Partridge was on.
Yeah.
Because I think the first Partridge sketch was written by Stuart Lee and Richard Herring, and they gave him the name. They gave him the name Alan Partridge, but they're not included as creators of that character since it's gone on to success. Like, you know, and I think it was a sore point for a while.
I booked tickets to him next year.
Coogan.
He Partridge, really. He's doing a tour of the British Isles.
Oh, right. Where are you going to see him?
Vicar Street.
Partridge would be amazing live, I'd say. Did he ever tour Partridge before, or is this the first time?
He did. He had I think this was a kind of a self-help. It's Partridge doing a self-help seminar thing. But the last time it was a sort of business consultant presentation about how you can make your business go.
Such a good
idea. Always has some sort of conceit, like Partridge is trying to do something and then it all goes to shit on stage in front of you.
That's going to be fucking great.
Maybe. Are you thinking that only because it'd be fucking great to be anywhere?
No, I would go to that. That sounds like it would be great, because you know right well, like Steve Coogan would have really good writers working on that. It would be a good show. It would be really well worked out. Like, you know, it wouldn't just be fucking some improv thing or whatever. Like, you know.
Yeah, hopefully we'll see. Hopefully it'll be on. Who knows?
Well, I mean, this is next year, though, isn't it?
Yeah, we might all be dead of the fucking Indian virus that's making people grow horns out of the middle of their heads and fucking limbs drop off and new symptom man. On the hour, every hour. That's the Ruttles. Dan, we haven't talked about the Ruttles.
That's all right. And one thing I was thinking about...
Go on.
What did you make... So you did love the film?
Yeah, I did. I really loved it. I thought it was very funny. Bill Murray was in it.
Yeah, but this is the thing. Eric Idle was well ensconced over in New York at that point. So, yeah, Bill Murray's in it. Isn't Dan Aykroyd in it?
Was Dan Aykroyd in it?
I think Dan Aykroyd's in it for a minute. And
was John Belushi?
John Belushi's in it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mick Jagger and Paul Simon are in it.
Mick Jagger was fucking loving it.
Yeah, yeah. He was actually pretty good at it.
He was very good at it. That's because that's a man well used to spinning mythologies, Dan.
Yeah.
First time I met the Ruttles, they came down to see us at Richmond, and we were just completely a number, you know, and they were standing there in their black suits. They'd just come off a TV show, and they were just standing there sort of checking us out, the opposition, and then they introduced themselves, you know, Dirt, Stig, Nasty, Barry.
I'd like to own a squadron of tanks.
They were very nice, you know. Because they'd heard about us, you know, because we were the South's answer to the Ruttles, you know, at that time.
Eric Idle was pushing on a lot of open doors in the States when he was
over. Yeah, he had had it with England. Like, he made that Rutland Weekend television for fucking no money whatsoever. They didn't even give him a proper comedy budget. It was something called a presenter's budget, which is the kind of budget they get for just those bullshit little talk shows. Like, it didn't really pay for anything, so... I think he was really fed up, like, and he was offered proper money to do stuff in the States. But also, they kind of say that the reason that there's a little bit, Neil Innes died a few years ago, but there was a little bit of animosity between them is because Eric Idle really wanted to be a rock star at that point. But he just wasn't, you know, he could write songs, obviously. Like, he wrote The Bright Side of Life, and he wrote the theme for One Foot in the Grave, and he wrote a lot of songs for Python, but... They're not stadium rockers. Like, you know, he was definitely working in a pretty small field, you know.
But he, of all the Pythons, had kind of the biggest careen off the motorway, did he not? By the 80s, he was doing like, what was he in? Like Splitting Hairs. And
I liked that. Was he in
that Cluedo movie?
I don't know. He was in Nuns on the Run with Robbie Coltrane. And he did at least a season of Desperately Seeking Susan as her boss. Do you remember that show? It was like a Brooke Shields sitcom.
I do. Brooke Shields. Your boyfriend has turned into the creature from the Blue Lagoon. The Black Lagoon. The creature from the Blue Lagoon is Brooke Shields.
What is that?
No. It's Buffy. It doesn't
It always makes me laugh. Watch her at all. But
Dawson's Creek, eh?
I was. What was it, one or the other? I didn't realize there was that rivalry.
Well, in Ireland, Dawson's Creek was not the exact same time as Buffy. Dawson's Creek was on RT1 and Buffy was on TV3.
Oh, okay.
So maybe other people figured out some way to have both, Danny, but I was not interested. I was in a Buffy house and that was all that.
Kind of the same show in a way.
do you know my favorite? My favorite Dawson's Creek joke is, you know, Liz Lemon's boyfriend in the last season of 30 Rock.
The really good looking guy.
Yeah. He, Jim James Marsden, plays him. But he has a van, and he calls his van, has he's given his van the nickname Van Der Beek because he's a huge James Van Der Beek fan. And that's they're sitting having the conversation, and she's like, don't you know, like in Dawson's Creek? And he's like, oh, I've never seen it. But you love James Van Der Beek. Yeah, I love everything. I've seen everything else that man's been in, but not Dawson's Creek.
What else has he been in? He's in that film that fucking Roger Avery made, the Tarantino's mate that was conned out of a co-writing credit on Pulp Fiction. He made a film with him.
What was that film?
Laws of Attraction.
Oh, okay. And, well, that sounds good. That sounds like the kind of thriller. I don't know. Tom Berenger would have acted across from Jessica Lange in the middle 80s in Laws of Attraction.
I like that bloke doing the voiceover. Yeah.
Can a man whose only goal has been power?
I can see why you would go back and watch those films.
I've gotten into a real kick of watching sort of 80s and 90s thrillers. I just like them.
They're done.
They're over. When they're finished, that's the end.
Yeah, they don't really make them anymore. And if they do, they're probably just not that good. Or they're like, you can see they're already kind of angling for a sequel or some kind of series or whatever. Like, you know.
Or you go to Netflix with them. Netflix says, well, okay, I like the idea, but can you make 10 episodes out of it? And you have to go, out of my 90-minute film premise, can I get you 10 hours of content? Yeah, sure. Probably every 10-episode Netflix series has 90 solid minutes in it. It just fucking stop all the
unwatchable stuff. Yeah. I can understand that because it's a story. It starts and it ends, and you got your five a day, like you got your full meal out of it, like, and that's it. Like, you know, it's you go around about the rest of your life. Like, I don't really buy into this business of being like, it doesn't have to be that all absorbing, all encompassing. It's a fucking film. It's on. It's over.
Yeah, it is.
I enjoyed that. I go and then I can go and make some potatoes or whatever the fuck I was going to do. Like, you know, it doesn't have to be like, oh, my mind was like fucking blown. Like, and it was 4 hours long or whatever. Like, you know,
it's learning to see the wisdom in there is a rhino loose in the city.
As in rhinoceros.
That's right. There's a rhino loose in the city.
What's it about, Bill?
Well, it's about, you see, this rhinoceros, right, escapes from the zoo and it heads straight for London, right? And after 2 or 3 days, they find all these, like, dead bodies lying about and no one knows who's done it, right? So they get hold of this private detective, you know, sort of like a Charlton Heston-type geezer, to try and solve the crime. Now, the zookeeper happens to be, you know, a very attractive woman. So, before you know where you are, old Charlton is giving the salt what for. So, that's your romantic interest.
Rhinoceros.
But I don't know it's missing.
How can you not know? Hell, if you've got a rhinoceros, right, and one day it ain't there, you tend to know it's missing.
This is why The Ruttles is so good. The Ruttles is poking fun at something that people took way too seriously. And as a society But as a society now, we take too many things far too seriously.
Yeah.
Everything has to be its own little enthusiast's run.
Well, that's what I hear a lot of people say is that, oh, I'm a big fan of this and I'm a big fan of that and I'm a big fan of this other thing. And if I consider myself a big fan of something, I know it inside out and upside down. Otherwise, I just like it. You know, you don't have to be a big fan. You can say, oh, I like Mr. Show. I don't know it inside out and upside down, but I do like it, you know.
Yes, exactly right. Exactly right. People, it's very irritating sometimes. It's very irritating sometimes. But, you know, what do you do? There's still stuff like The Ruttles out there.
Yeah.
I liked it. The actual TV special, I thought was great because there was a lot of sort of silly humor in it as well, like where Eric Idle's doing the reporter and he's doing the standard thing where he's walking down the street with the microphone. But then the camera is sort of at first imperceptibly speeding up, so he's having to start going faster to keep up with the camera. And in the end, he's running that.
I don't know. I felt like we'd seen that from him before. It wasn't really any kind of progression. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Maybe the Beatles thing was just sort of window dressing. Like what I was just talking about has nothing to do with the Beatles.
Yeah.
Maybe the Beatles thing was just kind of window dressing on same old, but
like if you think of it around that time, like John Cleese was doing Fawlty Towers probably at the same time, and I think Michael Palin and Terry Jones were probably doing Ripping Yarns, which is really good, or some of it's good anyway. And what do you call it? Terry Gilliam was doing whatever Terry Gilliam does, fucking screaming at a lamp in his house or something. Like,
he's trying to get one of his extraordinarily esoteric films financed.
Yeah, yeah. I'm being and mad being... that no one wanted to fucking finance it.
Yeah.
I'm always struggling against the man. It's like, no, you're struggling against the fact that no one wants to see this.
Yeah, yeah.
Why don't you just fucking illustrate it and stop annoying people?
Yeah, or just make some concession. And here's the thing about Terry Gilliam. I think he's at his best when he's working on some. My favorite Terry Gilliam film by a mile is The Fisher King. I love that film. The thing about The Fisher King is it plays almost as one of those sort of Harrison Ford thrillers. You could swap out Jeff Bridges for Harrison Ford for Jeff Bridges, and maybe it's sort of drama. And then weird things get studded through that film, like the bit in Grand Central Station where all the commuters start dancing.
It's
like
brilliant. It's a great scene. He nearly made Watchmen.
Yes, that's right.
Which would have been interesting.
Yeah, it would have been more interesting than what we got.
I read somewhere that Terry Gilliam didn't like the ending. He said, what's that term for something that's just thrown in at the end of something to end the story?
Oh, Deus Ex Machina.
Yeah, I think that's what he said it was, and he just didn't really like the ending. But apparently he met with Alan Moore and all that, and Alan Moore actually said, I think at the time, this was maybe even, it might have been the 80s, like, you know, when they were talking. And and I think at that point, Alan Moore was kind of interested. He was like going, I'd like to see a Terry Gilliam version of this. But apparently Gilliam just didn't like the story that much, you know.
He's wrong about it being a Deus Ex Machina. He's misinterpreting that. Very badly.
Yeah, he probably is. Yeah, it doesn't. Alan Moore has his exits covered a little bit better than that, I think.
I love that book. I love that book.
Well, the problem with the film that did come out of it, the problem with it was, is that it was just panels recreated from the comic, and it was just like without any of the extra depth in the comic, the extra stuff that you can read, like, you know, like even did the scene with Hallelujah over it of them having sex on the ship or whatever, like, and it's just like, this was written in the 80s, like, and it actually works in the comic with that song and everything, but to actually hear the sort of the Leonard Cohen version of that song with the kind of synthy keyboards and stuff playing over this like slow sex scene between two superheroes is like, this is the dumbest thing I've ever seen. It worked in the comic. Mm-hmm. It worked for because it's, and that song probably wasn't out that long when the comic came out, you know, that, and like, but to see it on screen 20 years later, done so like big and showy, it was just like, this is shit. Like, this is unwatchable fucking nonsense.
Exactly. It just, he made stuff look super slick and cool. But I think the point in the comic was actually, this isn't all that cool. And it's actually not okay that you would be thinking that this is okay. And you go to the film and he makes it look like the coolest fucking thing. God, yeah, I hate that film.
Bad.
That man, I'm sure he's a nice man, but man, I wish he'd leave the stuff I love alone.
There's one thing I was going to say about Neil Innes before we wrap up is that I was talking recently, I think you and I were talking on this show about, you mentioned Ed Sheeran and you made like, and I was kind of saying that all the people I listen to and admire and like are all kind of twats. They've all been, they've all been like outed as like sex pests and stuff. Like, you know, they've all turned out to be less than stellar people. I wish there was someone I could like that wasn't just like a creepazoid. Like, you know, and I think Neil Innes kind of might be that guy because by all accounts, he was a very easy bloke to work with. Like, and, you know, and even people who worked with him kind of said they felt he should have gone for it a little bit more because when that Ruttles thing came out, he could have done something that would have made him a bit bigger, but apparently he just was really into working with people.
No.
It was like a cartoon about a bunch. It was like a sort of prototypical Toy Story nearly. It was about a bunch of toys that came to life. But he wrote that series and wrote all the music. It was a show I watched when I was a kid. He did a thing called the Innes Book of Records for the BBC, which was like, it was, it's a good name. They were set to his songs and they were kind of, it was all music. There was no acting or script or anything in it. It was all film pieces set to his music. They're not music videos as such, because I suppose there's a little bit of narrative to them, but they were, he would, the show would be 20 minutes long or something, then be four songs in it. It would be four separate pieces of film to go with the four songs. I found it online recently and it's really good, you know, but it's, again, it's just like he was kind of overshadowed by the people he worked with, whether that was fucking Monty Python or Eric Idle or whatever.
The Beatles. It happened
to be. Yeah, the poor man was overshadowed by the Beatles, but the rest of us. But he, the fourth season of Monty Python's Flying Circus, which has got none of the sort of classic sketches in it, it was made after John Cleese left. They kind of did one more series. And he's in that as him and Douglas Adams were added to the team for that series to make it without John Cleese. And so Neil
Innes. Two men to replace him.
It took two men to replace John Cleese, yeah, which I'm sure he fucking loved.
Oh, yes.
So
there is still some good stuff in that season of Monty Python.
Yeah.
Isn't that the one where...
It's the one with the banter. Slout banter, sir. I think that one's in it.
Slout banter. That's a brilliant... That's one of my favourite Python sketches.
Yeah.
Jerry, Dickie Birdie pranked his kite right in the house of your father.
Fred, it didn't quite follow you, squadron leader. Give us it slower.
Banter's not the same if you say it's slower, Squiffy.
Hold on, man. Wingo! Yes, bend an ear to the squadron leader's banter for a sec, would ya?
Can do.
Jolly good. Fire away.
Bally Jerry, pranged his kite, right in the house your father. Harry Blighter, Dickie Birded, feathered back on his Sammy, took a waspy, flipped over on his Betty Harpers, and caught his can in the Bertie.
No, I don't understand that banter at all.
Something up with my banter, chaps. Bunch of monkeys on the ceiling, sir. Grab your Evan Falls and let's get the bacon delivered.
I stick it on sometimes because it's a really weird flavor compared to the rest of it. Like, you know, it's got a whole episode where Graham Chapman is like a superhero. That's shit. But there's something watchable about it because it's like, it's these people who are really, really good at what they do. But for some reason, it's just not coming together at all. And it's just like, it's like hypnotically shit. You know, it's shit in a really sort of intriguing way. Like, you know. And is the Montgolfier brothers in that one? Because I can't picture John Cleese in that one.
Okay. That was a good one too. Yeah. But my arms and neck are filthy.
Yeah, someone was saying that the only reason that Terry Jones wanted to do that scene where he came in a bathtub was because he'd gotten kind of ripped between the third and fourth season and he wanted to show off a little bit.
Is that true?
Yeah, apparently.
Don't remember
yeah.
him being ripped.
Like, well, no, he's not like fucking...
This was ripped for the 70s.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. It probably just meant that he'd fucking given up, who knows, fucking tripe or something, like, you know, whatever shit people are eating. Like,
you never see tripe anymore. I don't think I've ever had tripe, but, you know, the option has been taken away from me and I don't know if I'm entirely comfortable with that.
Yeah, I've never had Spam either, like, you know, but I think I've had, like...
Well, I've had Spam. Spam's all right.
I've had corned beef from a tin, like, you know, like a can of corned beef. Do you ever see it in those weird square tins? It's got the opener that is kind of a twisty one that goes around the whole can and you lift the top off it. And I was just like, I think my dad bought it once because he wasn't a great cook and he was making dinner. He bought this like tinned corned beef. And I was like, this is like something that comes with rations. Like, why are we eating it? Like,
but a lot of people developed a taste for that stuff back in the day. And Nutella is war food.
Is it?
Yeah, that was all invented war food. Corn is war food. But it was like, I mean, I do for occasionally go into, I'm only around the corner from McCormick's here, which is a very, very old style butcher's. And I go in there sometimes and get some weird, weird cooked meat, man. Some weird cooked meat. And you know they make it themselves because you can't get that shit anywhere else. There's nothing. There's like...
Do they still do the red pudding?
Yeah. Red pudding. And corned beef that's all crumbly at the edges. This can come out of no pack. Like this is scooped out of whatever drum they used to make it.
I'm intrigued by this. I'm intrigued by your weird meat, Niall. He wants to know Danny, more about it.
Danny, if I had a euro for every time, it would be that.
I guess that's is that all we've got?
Machine. Yeah, we've hardly talked about the Ruttles. I'm really sorry. I kind of enjoyed the TV show. If I was recommending somebody listen to the Ruttles, I would say watch the TV show first, get the context, and then it'll be much easier to. There's some really good bits in it. Like, I love the bit where he marries, falls in love with a French actress who spoke no English and very little French. It was just lines like that that made me laugh.
Yeah, the film was just like, it was just a bit sort of Python Leftover or something. I don't know. It was good. Like, Python Leftovers are better than most people's leftovers, you know, but I don't know.
It's not quite McCormick's corned beef.
Yeah, I just didn't. That's on the box, the Ruttles. Not quite McCormick's corned beef. So for the next episode, Niall, will we run with Pacific Heights? I kind of like that idea.
Yeah, 100% we will. Yeah, I want to watch it. I want to watch it now. Right. You literally only had to say the word and I was like, I don't think I've seen that since I was 13 years old. I'm watching it.
My apologies if it's cack, but it probably isn't. You know, it's probably all right.
No, we did well this week. I gave you cack last week, but I kind of actually enjoyed watching that cack. I'm going to use this podcast as an excuse to explore the lesser known avenues of my own personal history.
Yeah, I like that idea. I'm going to do the same. I like that approach. That's it from us for this week. Thanks very much for downloading. Fucking tell a friend or don't if you don't have any friends, whatever you got to do. If you're listening, we appreciate it. I got an email a few days ago that told me we're currently doing quite well in Ghana for some reason.
Oh,
it's got a random email from some kind of pod fucking podcast aggregator or something that said, your podcast is ranking highly in Ghana. So, hello, wow. If you're in Ghana.
Those Ghanis. That's supposed to be, Ghana's supposed to be lovely. I know some people. I know one person who went on holiday to Ghana years ago and he said it was beautiful.
Well, they certainly have good taste in podcasts.
They certainly do.
They certainly do.
Or else there's one Irishman that has just for the past 15 years been going on holiday to Ghana and he listens to podcasts. Right over now.
It's someone whose VPN has switched to Ghana and they forgot or something like.
Yeah, God knows what we're on that. We're sitting beside on that hard drive.
Yeah,
God knows.
All right, gang. Thanks very much for listening to us again for this week. We'll be back again soon. I've been Danny O'Hanlon.
I've been Niall McCann.
And Pacific Heights. Can't wait. See you then.
At times like these, when enemies can number more than friends, a friend indeed is what I need, not someone who pretends. I'm on my way, I cannot stay another day. You're such a pain, must I explain my every meaning to you? It's such a drag the way you nag at me and make me feel blue. I'm on my way, I cannot stay another day. You're so pusillanimous, so yeah. Nature's calling animals, go there. A glass of wine.